do this, and so you'll have to get along as best as you can. But it means that a lot of the time and effort that went in there was really wasted, because you don't have a guy who's a professional observer. And you can train a guy to be a professional observer. There's lots of courses that we never had an opportunity of to improve your memory. You can do memory courses. You can do observation courses. Photography is one of the things that you should train a guy. He should be trained for at least a year, not 2 weeks. And of course, the language is another one that you can train a guy for. He goes to language school for a year and he gets along, but that's about all. Whereas I'd been taking Russian for 15 or 20 years, and the Russians used to say, "You must have a Slavic background, eh?" I said, "No, I have a Scottish background." They said, "But you speak so well." I said, "Well, I've been practicing."
What were living conditions like in the Soviet Union?
For the Soviets?
For that, for you.
Well, they were very good, because we had special apartments. We had an apartment twice as big as most Soviet people had. We did have the opportunity to shop at their special shops for senior Russian officials and diplomatic people. We had was no rationing at all of the stuff on there. Now, you couldn't always get it, mind you, and sometimes the stuff they had in season was cheap and available, but not at all times. Then they started bringing in stuff from Canada, U.S. into these stores, and things got a little better then. But even so, you had to line up in the store. When we first went there, they had this archaic system of shopping, where you went in, you decided what you want, and you got a little slip of paper and two copies, of which one was kept by the clerk, and the other one you took to the cashier, and you lined up at the cashier's desk. You paid your money, you got it stamped, you take it back to the girl, if she hadn't sold it to somebody else in the meanwhile. You had to line up again, so you were lining up three times, and you finally got your one article. And you couldn't get all the articles in the same department. For instance, there was a meat department, there was a milk and dairy products department, there was a fresh vegetable department, and there was a tin goods department. So if you wanted, what we used to do is we'd take four people, go along, and each one of them would stay in the line and get the thing that was there. And then another guy would come around and collect the little chits, pay the thing, and the guys would still stay in the line. They cover up, distribute them. That was about the only way you'd get shopping done in a hurry. And the Russians did the same thing. They were, of course, past masters of this sort of...
Did the British Americans and Canadians get along? Did they share information?
Oh, yes, yes. It was practically, we had joint trips, for one thing. And we all wrote reports up at the end of each trip, and we would just pass them over to each other. So that it was really the only way you could do it. It also helped out because there were various people available to go on a trip, and if you had somebody who was a Navy expert, for instance, maybe the British Navy guy would be out of town or on leave or something, and so we'd lend him one of our guys, or the American would come along. So it was really very, very good cooperation, and it paid off. The Americans had the advantage of having satellite stuff that we didn't have, but they shared that with us. And so, mind you, it wasn't they didn't have the pictures in Moscow, but we used to fly out to London every 3 or 4 months to have a look at the pictures where they were there. But that was one of the before they wanted to really give out the extent of information they were getting from satellite pictures, how successful they were. Before the Russians had their satellite cameras going, we used to have to go on a lot of dumb things just to find out, just to establish presence there. So if somebody said, "Well, yes, our attachés report that in Rizan, for instance, that you've got three missile sites," well, how did they know that? Well, those attachés were in Rizan on that, and over this period of time, so they could have seen it. But then, of course, they get mad at the surveillance staff. It's like, "You didn't tell us these guys were near the missile sites." So, as I say, we had a lot of dumb objectives, which we knew were, you know, they were just a cover objective, and you just had to go there and go to the parks and cinema and see an opera or something. But one of them, purely by accident, every place we go, the in-tourist people who handle all tours and things would have a program for us, you see. They'd say, oh, well, now you're going to be here for 2 days. You must see this, you must see that. And you couldn't really ignore them because they were, you know, they were doing their job. But their idea was to keep you away from military installations. And so, in one of the places we went to, I can't remember its name now, it was down in the Southwest Asia here in, I guess it was Kazakhstan, yeah, Kazakhstan. And we sort of got held up getting in here because they said, oh, it's all fogged in, you can't take the plane off in daylight hours. So we had to wait for about 8 hours. Us and all the other 50 passengers on this plane had to sit around the airport until it got dark. So we were completely a day behind, and of course, when that happens, they don't give you an extra day on your trip. You got to leave at the time you scheduled to go. So that one was sort of we did a quick walk around town and counted the number of soldiers, and then in-tourist had arranged for us to go to a folk concert. Now, we thought, oh, that'd be great, Kazakhstan folk music, that must be really something else, eh? So we went to this in-tourist sponsored thing, they got us 2 tickets for it. And we got there, and the next 2 guys in the seat are obviously KGB fellas, and we sat down beside the biggest and loudest PA system I've ever heard, and a bunch of these folk artists came out with guitars, if you can believe it, and rock and roll. Oh, you've never heard anything like it. And it was just, you know, sort of 150 dB just hitting your ears, and we were sort of sitting there like this saying, gee, this is great, you know. So after the first intermission, these 2 guys bugged off. We could see them looking out behind the orchestra. But at any rate, we didn't think much of the Kazakhstan operation, excepting we had a good chance to talk to some Kazakhstanians. Most of them looked like Chinese, you know, and they were showing us pictures of their kids, and we showed them pictures of our kids, and so we had quite a good conversation with them. And but the next day, you know, the gal in the hotel, the in-tourist gal, comes down and says, oh, I've arranged a tour for you. Well, down here we have a famous agricultural fair. It's really an exhibition, but you'll find some stuff here that I'm sure you've never seen, you know, in Canada. So what are we going to do? You know, we're not going to do anything. We didn't have anything to do anyway. So we said, okay, we'll gladly go along. So we went around and walked around, took pictures of some old crop dusting airplanes and a Massey Harris combine. She said, look, see, Canada, Massey Harris, Canada. She thought that was, oh, absolutely, must take a picture of this. So we got a picture. And while I was walking around, the American attaché said, what are those antennas over there on that next, in the next field there? I said, God, they're military communications vehicles. And he said, look at the up on the top of the roof there. And here was a whole hassle-passel of new antennas. And so, anyway, we looked and saw that a bunch of agricultural instruments machines was right on the fence of this place. So the gal wasn't with us all the time, of course. She was supposed to be a guide and a chauffeur. So we said, oh, we're going to take some pictures of those things over there. Oh, sure, fine. So we walked over, and sure enough, it turned out to be a new tank barracks. Tank headquarters, actually. It looked like a tank brigade headquarters from the amount of communications they had. So we took pictures of us sitting on machinery, and in the background, of course, were all these things. So we gave her a big tip. She said, oh, we're not supposed to have tips. And so, well, you don't say, well, it's not for you, it's for your children. Oh, that's all right. Oh, dear. Well, I think that about covers the sort of general thing for this session. We might do some more later if I can think up. Did I tell you about the Congo? We haven't done that. Well, that's maybe a subject for another one.
Okay.
Well, this is Colonel Bill Hamilton speaking again, and I wanted to cover the events in Congo as far as it relates to the Canadian forces there during my period, which was roughly May 62 to June 63. and also give some of the background of how we got there and what we were doing. The whole Congolese situation, of course, was started when the Belgians decided that they were not going to give up the Congolese their Congolese colonial. I suppose it was a nation at that time. Anyway, it was their colony, the same way that the British had done, which was to do it gradually, and they just decided they'd pull out, and that decision led to tremendous upheavals in the Congo, because they weren't prepared to take over, the army being the only organization that had any strength at all. Immediately became major force in the whole of the Congo. Now, the army was not just one army, it was about three armies. There was an army in Katanga, there was one up in the Provence Orientale, Stanleyville, there was another one in Provence Ecateur, Gamina, and Coquilletville, and consequently, they immediately began to quarrel amongst each other as to who was going to run what where. The richest part of the Congo was in the Katanga, where they had diamond mines and copper mines and uranium mines. And of course, there were a lot of United States interests there because they were getting strategic materials from them. The rest of the country had not really the same type of resources, but they did have other things like ivory and certain materials that were of interest to the outside world. However, when the Belgians in a snit just took off, it left the whole place in a great uproar. And there were a number of conflicting interests. One was, of course, the chap who decided to become premier on his own, Patrice Lumumba, who was trained in Moscow and was asking the Soviets to come in and take over control of the Congo. Well, of course, this was absolutely anathema to NATO, who had a base actually at Kamina on the coast. There was a NATO base there, and they were very concerned about this and pushed through a United Nations resolution to help the Congo get on its feet. And they asked Canada would they send in a contingent of troops to help out with this. Well, there was a multinational force consisting of Ethiopians, Nigerians, Irish, Canadian, Indians, Pakistanis, almost every country that wanted to get a little experience in Africa went along, and the Canadian contingent was to provide communications, and that's how we got to go there. Now, of course, the problem of communications was absolutely tremendous, because the Republic of the Congo was about the same size as the three prairie provinces of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, and to go from one end to the other, especially under tropical conditions, was almost impossible. And the Belgians had not helped in keeping their communications going, and this was also compounded by the fact that the railways and the other communications means were including the Congolese river traffic, were completely out of order. So it was decided that the Canadians would set up a radio teletype link between the various capitals or headquarters of the Congo, including the port of Matadi, the capital Leopoldville, now known as Kinshasa, Leeuwarden, Kamina, which was a big Belgian air base, Albertville, which was on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, Bukavu, which was near Rwanda-Urundi, which was also a Belgian protectorate, but was slightly different, and up in the Provence Oriental, Stanleyville. Now, Stanleyville is very interesting because it, the people there they tend to be cannibals, and they like eating people, which they did. They ate a bunch of UN troops at one time. At any rate, that's how we have to decide to go there. And in order to get this thing launched, the 57 Signal Squadron was organized. Now, 57 Signal Squadron was a successor to the 56 Signal Squadron, which was organized in 1956. And the 57 Signal Squadron sort of followed on after that and was destined for the Congo. That was in the year 1960, so it didn't really have any relation. It just happened to be logical to call it 57 Signal Squadron. But at any rate, it was organized and tasked with supplying communications for the United Nations force in the Congo, which was known as ONUC. And we set this up at Berry Field and got suitable people, including radio operators, most of whom at first were supposed to be bilingual, but didn't really turn out that way because our source of bilingual signalers soon ran out. However, the important thing was to get the communications equipment. We did not have any equipment at the time. However, the Americans, who were very interested in making sure that this mission was a success, provided us with 13 AN/GRC-26 Angry 26 sets, including vehicles, and we got them, drove down, have them driven up to Trenton, and shipped out to Leopoldville. Now, the thing is that our aircraft couldn't take these things. The only ones that we would get them on were American Globemasters, so the U.S. Air Force shipped them out there. And the 57 Signal Squadron also were trooped out there and got into action. Now, they didn't get in there without any difficulties. They really did have some difficulties. The Congolese, unfortunately, didn't appreciate the fact that any white man wasn't a Belgian. And we had a lot of Royal 22nd soldiers with us, either as communications or general duties people, because they could all speak French. And their shoulder badges were almost the same colors as the Belgian flag. So, of course, they were immediately mistaken for Belgians, and they got beat up at the airfields, and they were put in the pokey, and it was really however, we got that straightened out and stopped wearing Royal 22nd Belgian flags on our shoulders. So, at any rate, we set up in a number of different places, as I said, Matadi on the coast, Leopoldville, Stanleyville, Bukavu, Albertville, and Elizabethville, and also at Kamina, which was the big Belgian air base, and which had been taken over by a Swedish contingent. That covers really the area and the way we got in there, and without too much difficulty, communications were established, although they were difficult in being equatorial and a lot of thunderstorms and day and night conditions were different. We did manage to quickly establish communications and got things under control. Now, we also had another task there, and that was which the Royal Canadian Air Force took on, and they were to train Belgian, or at least the Congolese air controllers, because when the Belgians took off, they just pulled everyone out, and mind you, not without some trepidation, because they were being pillaged and raped, and so every Belgian just got the hell out of the Congo, and for some good reason, including all the air controllers. So here they were left without the air controllers. Well, Canada did provide a bunch of Air Force air controllers, and took on the task of training the Congolese, which was another interesting point, that they did quite well training them. Also, they ran a rear link from Leopoldville, which is the capital, back to Trenton, and we set that up, and a link from our UN headquarters out to the airfield, which was very important because we controlled all the UN flights from New York, Trenton, and the base in Italy, Pisa. At Pisa, there was an airfield there. So that's the way that most of the UN equipment came, was by air. Well, first they used to bring it in by Matadi, but the Matadi to Leopoldville railway and river traffic wasn't terribly reliable, so they finally had ended up that it all came in via RCAF. So the Canada's involvement in the Congo was both army, mostly signalers, but also some other mainly French-speaking personnel, and RCAF. Almost everyone that went to the Congo was in one way or another bilingual, and as a matter of fact, they asked if I was bilingual, and they said yes, he's bilingual. They didn't say that I was a Russian speaker bilingual, but I, as a matter of fact, I was fairly bilingual en français. But however, they were able to say yes, he's a qualified linguist, etc., etc. So after all these difficulties, which I'm sure that Brigadier General Smith and Colonel Bindoff will be able to put down here, turned out that I was sent to relieve Colonel Buster Setham, who was the second commander. First commander was General Smith. He was a colonel then, and he spent a year out there getting things organized and going through all the difficulties, including having his people blown up and shot at and put in jails and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, this is the sort of stuff that turns your hair gray, if it wasn't gray before, or white afterwards. And as a matter of fact, one of General Smith's young gentlemen, who is was a lieutenant from the Royal 22nd, I guess he was captain in the Royal 22nd, in Stanleyville, had his whole detachment arrested and thrown into a jail. Now, a jail in the Congo is something that you wouldn't believe. It was sort of like tiger pits, and they throw you into a cellar with bars on top, and your food is thrown down, and the guards pee on you, and all that sort of good stuff. Anyway, this captain went to see General Lambula, who was the local commander, and who wasn't taking any orders from the general of the ANC, who was General Lumumba. Well, no, it wasn't Lumumba. It was after his time. At any rate, he wasn't taking. It was sort of, they were all at odds, and so this chap went in, dressed in his desert uniform, with no pistol or anything, and said he wanted to see General Lambula. And he brought a bottle of whiskey with him, and he said, you know, this is always a good entree to a Congolese general. And he said, I'd like to have a few words with you, General, and pulled up the bottle of whiskey, and the general said, yeah, certainly, sit down. Got a couple of glasses out, and they shared the bottle for a while, and then he said, what can I do for you, monsieur? And he said, well, you got five of my guys in your jail. And he said, oh, that's terrible. All these people are putting people in jail. They never tell me anything about it. And so he said, well, who can I see to get them? I said, well, I don't know anything about that. So whereupon the captain reached into his back pocket where he had a pistol, and he shoved it into General Undula's ear and said, I'd call for the fellow that can release these guys from jail, because in 1 minute I'm going to blow your ear out, one inside and out the other. And of course he said this in French, and General Undula thought he was bluffing for about 10 seconds, and then when the guy started pulling back on his finger, he called for his assistants, said, get them guys out of jail and onto the airplane, which they did, of course, and we didn't go back to Stanleyville for a while, as you can imagine. Well, when I got to the Congo in 1962, May 62, things were pretty quiet, and they were fairly well organized. There was always the possibility of a renewal of operations with Katanga. In Katanga, of course, Monsieur Chambé, who was the Katangese leader, and from a different tribe of the East Congolese, and one of the things that I should have mentioned before was the fact that tribalism was really rampant in the Congo. Now, you don't understand how big the Congo is and how the Belgians had tried to put it all together and integrate the tribes, but tribalism is one of the curses of the Congo, and well, of the whole of Africa for that matter. And the tribes that are in the east look down on the tribes that are in the west. Some tribes are agricultural, some tribes are very warlike, and they're the warriors. Other ones are technically skilled. And the Belgians had exploited this by making the people who were technically skilled into engine drivers, telephone operational people. They ran the steamers in the river. They were, sort of a different bunch of people than the agricultural people. Now, the agricultural people just couldn't even open up a pair of scissors and cut something with it. They just used a panga and just cut it. So these people were used to do the things that they wanted to do. The other people were the warriors, and of course they were always fierce and warlike, and they became the police. They were used by the Belgians to keep all the other tribes in control. And of course this led to the point that these tribes hated each other, not only from times archaic, but from local times. And the fact that these technical people were being paid for driving engines and running telephones and radios, when the revolution came, it was the chance of the warriors and the agriculture people to get even with them, and so they just shot them. The first thing they did was to say that everyone must go back to their own tribal areas, and so they took them all out of Leopoldville and the capital, put them on trains, and sent them back home. Said you're going to have to do your thing there. Well, of course their thing was agricultural or something, which they couldn't possibly do, because these guys have been for 100 years have been technicians. And a couple of trains were stopped, ransacked. They shot everybody, ate half of them, and put the rest of them into deep freezes to keep for Christmas or something like that. And it was just a shambles. But however, that had been sorted out by the time I got there. However, Katanga had declared itself to be independent, and Monsieur Chambé ran Katanga as a separate country. And he was supported by this, somewhat by the Belgian government and somewhat by the American government, because it was the source of strategic materials, diamonds, uranium, good stuff for making high quality steel. They had the chromium there and other stuff, which meant that of course they were completely so the major event that happened after I got there was the fact that the Katangese had a number of mercenary troops, most of whom were British and Belgians, agitating to continue the war and stop any further infiltration from Leopoldville. Now they had a couple of United Nations attempts at at ending this confrontation between Katanga and Leopoldville. And in fact, Chombe came to a meeting in Leopoldville, and because they were afraid that he was going to be captured and executed like he was later on in his life, he stayed with the Canadian contingent. We had a place for him to eat and sleep, and we were responsible for guarding him. So the meetings went on. Chombe was not kidnapped on that occasion, and but however, they didn't come to any conclusion. It was unfortunate, but he went back to Katanga and did his thing there. Well, at that time, the Katangis, urged on by the mercenaries, many of whom are from northern Rhodesia, decided to provoke the United Nations troops in Elizabethville. Now, there was a whole division of Indians from the Indian Army in Elizabethville. They also had a brigade in Albertville and various places where the UN were, Bukavu, etc. And they began firing mortar shells into Elizabethville. Of course, the UN troops there were under duress, having been shelled. They happened to hit a hospital, and of course that made a great amount of publicity. And decided the local divisional commander decided he was going to take matters into his own hands. So he crossed into the Jadoville, Kalwezi area of Katanga, which was just across the river in Elizabethville. And then he cut all his communications. He said, "Oh, they've been blown up, you see. Goodbye." And of course, our chaps in Elizabethville had long given up all their mobile communication capabilities. They were sitting in this hospital, actually, in the basement, so they couldn't move anything. And the Indian division just chased the Katangis across the river down and wiped them out. So they all surrendered, and that was the end of the Katangis War. And of course, Chombe took off to somewhere in North Africa, where he finally got his. But at any rate, that was the end of the Katangis War. And of course, in Leopoldville, this had been a great matter of debate, and the commander, who was an Ethiopian, General Kabedi, who was the commander of UN forces in the Congo, was very concerned about this because his previous experience in tactical operations had been when there had been a revolt in Ethiopia, and the famous Ethiopian king, what was his name, king? Who was the emperor of Ethiopia? Haile Selassie had been out of the country and was overthrown by a palace revolution. And General Kabedi, who at the time was a lieutenant colonel, hadn't been told about this revolution. And so he'd being head of the palace guard, had stopped the whole thing, wouldn't let anybody take control of the palace, and consequently was rewarded for his quote-unquote loyalty by being made a major general, and he got sent to the Congo. But at any rate, he wasn't really sure of what they should do about the fact that the Indians had gone off chasing the Katangis. So we had a meeting, general staff meeting, and I was asked for my opinion. I said, "Well, if you can't," he said, "you know, as the chief communicator, what can we do about getting in touch with the Indians?" And I said, "Well, you can't do anything about it." I said, "If they're winning, let them go on. If they're not, we'll get in touch. They'll get in touch with us." So, at any rate, they were winning, and they put the route to the Katangis, and that was the end of the war. So, as I say, that's that was the end of really operations in the Congo as far as warlike activities were concerned. Canadians in Leopoldville had a fairly good time. Their term of duty for the average soldier was 6 months, and although it was continuous summer there, there was the wet season and the dry season, and we had lots of facilities to keep the soldiers happy. They went on leave either to Matadi, which was a sort of a resort area on the coast, or they could go back to Pisa and spend a week there. The officers spent a year in the Congo, which was, I suppose, really necessary, because it took you about 6 months to get to know the country and the people, and it was really not fair to pull a guy out after 6 months when he just got to be really effective. So most officers spent a year in the Congo. And all our detachment commanders, which I think we had six of them, were French-speaking, most of them from French-speaking regiments, or they were of bilingual background. And so we had a really mixed bag, and it worked out very well, because we got on very well with each other, and we had people of French culture and English culture, all of whom could speak French to a certain extent, and had the common feeling of being in a war that wasn't a war. There were a lot of very difficult situations when we were there. At one time, the Congolese army, the Armée Nationale Congolaise, ANC, were about to revolt, and they were going to take over the government. And of course, we were all put on the alert and had to work out what we would do, and we issued live ammunition to everybody, and were ready to take off. At the same time, in the year 19, I think it was 61, we had the Cuba crisis. And the question was, what would we do with Canadian troops if a war broke out between USA and Russia and Canada was involved? So we had a sealed order, which was not to be opened unless, so I immediately opened the damn thing, because I didn't want to wait till D-Day before we had to open the thing. And it said we were supposed to take our troops and fly them to North Africa, and then walk them down to meet up the rest of the Canadians who were in 56 Signal Squadron. And what we were to do then, we had no idea. So I sort of thought, well, gee whiz, if there's anything like this goes on, we're gonna walk to South Africa. At least that's one place we'll get to speak to people that can talk Canadian. So anyway, that was our mystery tour, which we fortunately never had to take. The other interesting thing, of course, was the fact that we had visits from all sorts of Canadians, the people who were working in the United Nations, and they came out for various reasons. We had an Indian hospital, which was the hospital and dental facilities, which everyone, if they were really desperately sick, would go to, but I don't want to be racist about this, but it wasn't the place to go. And they had, it was the last remaining dental clinic that had a guy driving a bicycle to run the drill. And one of our guys had to go there, and believe me, he said he finally, this guy wasn't turning the wheel fast enough, so he reached out and he grabbed this guy by his knackers, and he said, "Faster, faster." to which the fellow responded by pedaling twice as hard. Obviously, he didn't have a 10-speed dental drill. So, this was the sort of things that went on there. We were, I suppose, the Canadian soldiers were fairly happy. We did have a few incidents. I had to send a couple of my guys home for indiscreet things that they did, mostly after NCOs, parties, and that sort of thing. But however, on the whole, I think we made our our mark on the Congolese and got along with them. There was, but you had to understand, this is the thing that I didn't understand when I got there, you had to understand the African mentality. For instance, and here's a good for instance, we wanted a amateur radio frequency to talk back to Canada. And, of course, being a purist, I said, well, we'll have to get the Congolese to authorize this, you see. So we went down to see them, and I sent down my administrative officer, and he went in to see the Minister of Communications, and the guy said, oh, yes, thank you very much. Merci, monsieur. And he put the thing upside down in his basket. He couldn't read either French or English, and so the application sat there, and next week we went down to see what had happened to it, and oh, it was in his basket. He was shuffling through the papers. Yes, there it is. Voila, voila, monsieur. And he said, but we haven't got a frequency for you yet. And so I said, hey, what the hell goes on here? So my atom officer said, well, sir, you didn't send him down his two bottles of whiskey. And he said, I said, is that what it costs to get a frequency? He said, yeah, that's right. Okay, I said, well, take him and give him three bottles of whiskey and drink one of them yourself while you're there. So he went down with his three bottles of whiskey and shook them in his little bag and said, voila, monsieur, have you given us our frequency? And the guy shuffled through his paper thing, and he said, oh, yeah, voila, voila. And he put a big, his name on the thing and said, merci, merci. And they sat down and they consumed about half of the bottle, of one of the bottles, and the guy, he went off with quite happily, and so we got our frequency. But, when you first go there, you think, oh, gee, I'm not going to do this sort of thing. But, however, that is the whole business of working with that particular government. Now, maybe it's changed, I don't know. But at any rate, I think that you had to learn a lot. And I learned a lot there about working with primitive peoples. You know, they say they're just down from the trees. Well, a lot of them are, but a lot of them aren't. There are a lot of smart people there. And we worked with the PTT, telephone people, and boy, they have some really smart guys. You know, the natives that were Congolese nationals, that they were really good. Of course, after they got them out of the deep freezes. Anyway, I think that's probably... maybe we'll come back next year and do a little more of this. And I'd like to get both Colonel Bindoff and General Smith together, and perhaps we can do this, because when General Smith comes down, whether you're here or whether we can do it with Reg Roy, I would think that it would be worthwhile, because there's so much that has not ever been put down on paper, you know, other than, you know, we got a little bit here.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very good to make sure that this is preserved for the future. See if I can think of anything else now that should go on here. While we were out there, they had the election in Canada when the Conservative government decided to call an election. And of course, they had to ensure that every Canadian soldier serving in Africa got a chance to vote, and they sent out a special airplane with ballot boxes and everything to get us to vote. But the person who was responsible for this called up and didn't take any notice of the fact that we were 10 hours difference or 9 hours difference in time between Ottawa and Leopoldville. And consequently, he called in the middle of the night. And, of course, he couldn't get hold of anybody in the middle of the night. We had billets and quarters that were scattered all over Leopoldville. And so, although we had a duty officer, this poor duty officer said, well, I have an emergency telephone call from the chap who's in charge of voting in Canada. I said, voting? What the hell? Who the hell's voting in Canada? We hadn't heard that there was going to be an election or anything. He said, oh, yes, you must come to the phone. Well, my phone didn't have any connection to it. I couldn't get through to the phone. Said, oh, yes, he's calling on international telephone, and he wants you to call him back as soon as possible.